From the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, I'm Robert Caceres, and this is The Reframe. Today's guest is Dr. Brian Canfield. Dr. Canfield is a professor of counseling at Ford Atlantic University and currently serves as IMFC's Director of International Education and Development. He's a past president of IMFC and a fellow and a past president of the American Counseling Association. With over 30 years of clinical experience, Dr. Canfield is an internationally recognized expert in the field of marriage and family counseling, specializing in marital issues and family conflict. He recounted some of the valuable lessons he's gained throughout his career and stressed the importance of self-care for maintaining clinical effectiveness and safeguarding against professional impairment.
All of your education, all of your training, all of your clinical experience, all of your work in helping others in no way inoculates you to problems of the human condition. In no way. You're going to have relationship problems. You're going to feel anxious. You may become depressed. And when we as counseling professionals start to think that somehow we're more highly evolved or we're at some place where we're immune to the human condition, we're setting ourselves up for a lot of grief. So I think we need to practice a lot of self-care with that, because I've seen time and time again, say in my particular area of marriage counseling and couples therapy, if I'm struggling with marital issues or I'm on the verge of facing a divorce, it makes it real difficult to compartmentalize that and work effectively with couples. So the self-care is not just for my own benefit. It's so that I can maintain my effectiveness with my clients. So my advice very clearly is monitor yourself closely, do all the things we tell our clients to do in terms of healthy living. And then when you encounter issues, seek out professional help. Don't be a hypocrite.
Welcome to The Reframe. Over the next hour, you'll hear Dr. Canfield discuss the common relational pitfalls he encounters when working with couples and describe how his research on family of origin issues informs his clinical work. Dr. Canfield also highlights his approaches to working with potentially deceptive clients and explains the importance of bracketing one's personal values and setting realistic expectations when counseling couples who are considering divorce.
It's very important for anybody who is doing couples work to respect your client enough to allow your client to make those life choices and not to directly or even indirectly impose your own values onto the couple. It's critically important. I'm there to help. I'm not there to guarantee any kind of fix.
I began our conversation by asking Brian to discuss his path from studying psychology as an undergraduate to ultimately pursuing a career in practicing and teaching marriage and family counseling.
I entered the counseling profession as a graduate student in 1979. I completed an undergraduate in psychology. And as we all know, psychology is a good general studies degree, but it does nothing to prepare one professionally. And so kind of considering the prospects in the late 70s, we had at my school, Louisiana Tech University, a master's program in counseling. This was all pre-K-CREP and, you know, that sort of thing. And so applied to the program, was accepted. It was at the time kind of typical, a 33-hour program. And I can remember getting some of my clinical hours in residence halls by putting out a sign saying, you know, counseling available. And finishing up, I knew that I really didn't know enough to be turned loose on an unsuspecting public. We didn't have licensure except in a couple of states at the time. And so that was really my motivation to pursue doctoral work. So I went and took a job at LSU in Baton Rouge for a year in student affairs and applied to doctoral programs, and was accepted to school in Commerce, Texas, which is now Texas A&M Commerce. It was a counseling program, but it was one of the first programs that was emerging with an emphasis in marriage and family therapy. And at the time, I think it was one of two or three in the country that was accredited by COAMFT and AMFT. And so I kind of lucked into it. Had a number of professors there, and it just seemed like an alignment of, just people who have been prominent in the field. Robert Smith, Alan Hovestat, David Fennell, Patricia Love, just to name several of them, were all professors of mine and mentors of mine. So I was very fortunate to be able to study under them, and many of them, all of them, in fact, have continued to be lifelong colleagues and friends. So part of the way that I approach my work as a professor is that I see graduate students, and particularly my PhD students, as colleagues in training. And so part of my job is not only to help them expand their knowledge and their skills, but to also help them to enter into the profession and become part of the profession with that. So when I finished up my doctorate in 83, I returned to my native state of Louisiana and opened up a private practice. And I was in private practice on a full-time basis for about 6 years with a fellow colleague who was from Louisiana, and had taught a couple of courses adjunct in the psychology department at LSU Shreveport, and presented at a state conference, as always members of professional associations at the state level and ACA, but had presented at a state conference, and Dr. Don Locke, who was the associate dean at Monroe, University of Louisiana at Monroe, had approached me afterwards, and he said, "We have an open faculty position. Would you consider applying for it?" And I'd never considered myself on an academic track, never considered myself a faculty type person. But I said, "Sure, you know, I'll participate in the interview. I mean, you know, what's it going to set back with that?" And lo and behold, they offered me the position, and that launched me into an academic career that's been 35 years. And I have been a tenured full professor at 5 different universities. I've gone through, held a number of administrative roles, including department chair, associate dean, and even did a brief stint as vice president for academic affairs. I'm currently a professor of clinical mental health counseling at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, and love the job because I'm able to work closely with master's and PhD students, but I have no formal administrative duties. So I really kind of like teaching and like doing the research and like doing the work with that.
Yeah, it sounds like you're living the dream.
There's some nightmares along the way, but yeah, I feel very fortunate. You know, you look at some of the data that kind of a rough statistic, about 70% of Americans don't like the work they do. And I love what I do. And it was the sort of thing that even if I were to have won the lottery and didn't have to worry about things, I'd still teach. I mean, I really, really love teaching. I love clinical work. I love supervision. And particularly am very fortunate to do quite a bit of international teaching and consulting as well.
Well, part of that dream that you're living, I guess, is that you also have time where you make a concerted effort to do clinical work. Could you tell me a bit about the clinical work that you do?
Sure. Well, one of the things in my administrative roles, I've always encouraged faculty to engage in part-time consulting, supervision, clinical work, because I think it adds a dimension to your teaching people to become counselors and therapists if you're actually out there doing the work yourself. So it's kind of twofold. One is it provides a little bit of supplemental income in addition to university salary. But I think more importantly is it keeps my clinical skills honed and current so that I can bring back into the classroom those kind of ongoing experiences. At present, I have a practice that is, you know, limited but pretty active in terms of the scope. I'm, you know, maybe 5 hours per week, you know, in terms of seeing clients on average. And I made a conscious decision probably about 10, 12 years ago to focus on marriage counseling and couples therapy. I think that dyadic relationship is so critical and pivotal to not only the health and well-being of individuals, of the individuals in the relationship, but also family members, children. And so if we can do things that help stabilize and improve a marriage or relationship that's in trouble, I think it has a lot of effects that reverberating effects that are positive for and a whole range of people. So that's what I focus on. I still get contacted by individuals who, you know, seek out individual counseling for various issues. But one of the things that we know as family counselors is that an individual doesn't exist in isolation. They exist in a context. And invariably, one of the most powerful aspects of that relational context is a significant relationship, whether it's a marriage or a partnership.
Well, can you tell me more about some of the common presenting issues that you address?
Sure. Well, if you know, my experience, and I think this is kind of consistent with the literature, is that I'd say about 60% of couples that come to see me that are married, or even those that are not married, that about 60% is because of an affair or the suspicion of an affair. And that's a very prominent issue. A lot of people think that, well, that's a deal breaker. If my partner were to cheat on me, relationship's over. But then you discover that you still have maybe strong connection or feelings for them. You find out you may have invested a lot together for many years, that you may have children together, you know, with that. And so a lot of times a person will come in and they're in a quandary. They certainly abhor the betrayal of trust in the relationship, but they're not ready to just throw everything out. And so often that will be a catalyst to get them into counseling. So that's a prominent symptom of a dysfunctional relationship. The most common problem that couples present with are financial, by far. Financial issues and marital problems kind of run hand in hand. And then you can layer on top of that, in addition to finances, you're looking at relationships with in-laws, you're looking at differences in parenting style, particularly for blended families who may have children from prior relationships. And then probably fourth down the list, I would say, would be sexual issues, intimacy issues. But by far, finances are the number one thing that kind of put couples at odds with each other.
Well, in your extensive experience of addressing financial issues with couples and families, what are some of those basic approaches or mindsets that you found to be helpful and effective in addressing that issue?
Surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, it isn't about money. It's not about how much is coming into the marriage or coming into the family, because I work with some very prominent and successful couples, medical doctors, attorneys, various positions, and they'll be making high six-figure annual incomes, and they're on the verge of divorce over money. So it's not about the commas. It's not about the dollar amount in the bank. It's about the control, the power, the entitlement, the differences of philosophy that people run into. And so you look at the disparity when one spouse makes significantly more, maybe the sole earner compared to the other. And so when I'm addressing, quote, money issues with couples, it's not about developing a budget and sticking to it. It's about kind of getting on the same page in terms of your philosophy and how you work in as partners, how you work in concert to develop a complementary relationship in which essential tasks, essential roles are divided and defined. And so often the counseling process with couples is kind of getting an understanding of where things are structurally and helping those couples renegotiate and come up with a structure and an agreement that is workable. What I often find is that couples often start out very well with their understanding about the role of being a spouse, and it evolves over time so that the person in their mid-20s may feel one way about marriage and a relationship, but when they're in their mid-50s, it may be quite different with that. And I also do quite a bit of work with same-sex couples, and the issues are identical. There's no real distinction between heterosexual or homosexual couples in terms of that. The same issues tend to kind of bubble to the surface.
Well, going back to the financial issues, that seems like it would be such an emotionally charged pattern that the couple has found themselves in, that, you know, there may be these differing perspectives, and yet each person may be very entrenched in, you know, the correctness or the, you know, justifications for their perspective. How do you break down some of those initial barriers or those you know, divergent perspectives?
Well, my initial research and early work was in on family of origin issues and how we gain from our family of origin, either as a direct message or an indirect message, our values and beliefs and expectations, not only about life, but about relationships. You know, that's You can embrace what your family presented you. You can reject it. You can modify it, but you cannot escape it, because that's kind of the mile marker. That's kind of the reference point from by which you evaluate all subsequent life relationships. One of my favorite quotes was by James Framo, who was a noted family therapist out of Houston who passed away a couple years ago. But Framo said that marriage is nothing more than two alien tribes sending out their respective emissaries to do battle, to decide whose traditions will survive into the next generation. I love that quote. And so I think a lot of it is that spouses enter into a relationship, into a marriage, with certain preconceived notions of how it's supposed to be. And when their partner doesn't share or embrace those notions, it can cause conflict, or often it'll cause resentment that builds up over time with that. So part of the process, I think, of successful couples work is to legitimize and put out there that your beliefs and your expectations about how things, quote, should be are not inherently wrong, but they're not the same as what your partner holds. So let's put those respective beliefs out there. Let's talk about them. Let's maybe try to negotiate a different way to do things. I find a lot of couples struggle because both of them try to adhere to some notion of what they think marriage should be like in financial terms. And neither of them want to do it, but they think this is kind of the off-the-shelf model I'm supposed to follow. So part of my job is to help them be creative in developing, serving as the architects for what kind of marriage they would like to have. You know, how would you like for finances to work? In some families, some couples, you have a sole earner. So others, you have dual income families. Others, you have one spouse may make significantly more, the other spouse may make a fractional amount. There is some research, I think originally was out of Sweden and then I think replicated in the U.S. that looked at in the United States that dual income couples are actually report a higher level of satisfaction than single earner families. But the qualifier to that is that when a woman makes significantly more than her husband, it causes a lot of problems in relationships. And you know, why is that? You know, and well, we look culturally upon how men are defined in the U.S. and being providers. And so the research kind of suggests that the ideal mark is when a woman is making between 40 and 60% of the income that the husband makes. So the husband doesn't feel, emasculated. He doesn't feel like he's not performing. And I've worked with couples where the wife was a surgeon, or maybe she was a pharmaceutical sales rep and, you know, making $400,000 a year. And the husband maybe had a great job making about $80,000 a year, but just couldn't handle the fact that his wife was so financially successful. I remember one case in particular, he felt that it just kind of reflected negatively upon him and couldn't understand why the world would pay this woman $400,000 and only pay him $80,000, you know, with that. So I think those disparities, those family of origin issues, cultural framework in terms of what men are supposed to do and what women are supposed to do, that has been evolving, certainly within my lifetime. If we go back to the mid-1970s, prior to about 76, the majority of married women with school-aged children worked primarily at home. After the mid-70s, the majority of married women with school-aged children work primarily outside of the home. So we've seen a real shift in the role of women in society. And what one would think is, well, that shift's a good thing. But if we look at it closely, we find that the roles for women haven't really changed. They've expanded. So women continually, in many cases, I'm speaking in generalities, but in many cases, women continue to cling to the notion of performing the traditional roles of mother, of wife, but they have the additional burden of being a full-time worker outside of the home. So you have a situation where the expectations and demands on women have expanded, and those are often imposed by mothers and grandmothers and, not the women themselves. They'll turn to their spouse, typically a husband, and say, I need more from you. And the husband would respond and say, basically, I'm burning the candle at both ends now. You know, I'm pursuing a career full time to provide for our family, and you're asking me to do more when I really feel that I'm at my, you know, max, at my peak productivity as it is. So a lot of marital conflict kind of comes out of that. I think the expanded role of women and opportunities for women is a wonderful thing, but it also requires a redefinition of marriage. If we look at marriage, women no longer marry and haven't for some time for economic security and social status. Society, you know, women are quite capable of providing for themselves. So for many women, the motivation to marry is companionship and to have a partner. And that requires that redefinition of marriage requires, in many senses, rejecting the model of marriage that your grandparent or your great-grandparent held with that. And it, creates a bit of a difficulty. If we look at the statistic at the year 1900, about one in 19 marriages in the U.S. ended in divorce. Okay. By the post-World War II era in the 1950s, it was about one out of seven marriages ended in divorce. And the peak In the 1980s, it's about one out of two ended in divorce. Right now, we've made a little improvement, a little less than 50% end in divorce. But we've gone from close to one out of 20 to almost half of all marriages ending in divorce. And I think that directly correlates with the changing role of marriage in our society and the expectations that both men and women or partners bring into the marriage.
Well, the way that you kind of characterize the various transformations of employment and gender roles and expectations and responsibilities as they're divided among partners, and also just those staggering statistics on divorce, it almost paints a very bleak picture of, you know, why would anyone get into couples counseling when, like, the results are not great. But at the same time, you know, you're someone who has extensive experience and clearly in your ability to cite the literature, have done a lot of research. What would you say in the midst of all of that harrowing depiction that you portrayed would be some of the common pitfalls that maybe initially you found yourself falling into or you kind of see your students falling into?
Sure, sure. Well, I think often, you know, we can look at statistics and we can draw erroneous conclusions. So let's go back to the statistic in the year 1900. One out of 19 marriages ended in divorce. So marriages were more stable. They were more durable. So therefore, couples must have been happier. You know, the spouses must have been more satisfied in their life roles. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that you had people who were absolutely miserable, but society did not allow them to exit a miserable relationship. Whereas now, that's socially accepted and even encouraged with that. So I don't know that we can look at it as inherently a good thing or bad thing that the frequency of divorce has increased as it has. I think in many respects it's a very bad thing, but in other respects it's also given options that grandparents, great-grandparents did not have access to. So this has really empowered and freed women in a lot of ways and men as well with that. But divorce is by and far horrific. And one of the things that I try to help couples recognize is that divorce is not a solution to your problems. Divorce is a substitution. You're trading a known set of problems and frustrations for a new set of problems and frustrations, some of which you may anticipate, some of which you do not anticipate. And so I caution couples, as long as there's any degree, any percentage of ambivalence about the marriage, to spend the time and energy to explore that, to see if it's possible to stabilize and improve the marriage. That don't look at divorce as a solution. Look at it as it's perhaps when you're confronted with all bad choices, it may be the least bad choice in some situations. But I think that often there's a tendency to kind of look at it as the go-to solution. So when I'm working with a marriage, working with couples and the relationship is unstable, one of the things I'll ask them to do is to agree to a time-limited period to work on the relationship without any contemplation or threat of separating or divorcing. And I usually try to extract at least a 3-month commitment, but I'm more comfortable when they will, you know, give each other about a 6-month commitment. Because I think what happens is that as you're working to improve a relationship, there are going to be good days and bad days. You're going to hit a bump in the road. And the next bump you hit in the road, you don't want somebody to act upon it and say, you know, to heck with this, I'm out of here. I don't want counseling. I want to talk to an attorney, you know, get divorced with that. So I think by couples making that commitment, because what we know is if we look at the long-term pattern of marriages, of couples who've been married multiple decades, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, that if you look at what couples report on that, they'll say, there are times I felt close and connected to my partner and my spouse, and there are times that I didn't. And so what we find from that is that the pattern of marriage is that there's times of closeness and there's times of distance emotionally, and you connect with each other. And that's kind of the pattern of long-term marriage, is you're close and then you disconnect. So the key, and people always ask me this, what's the key to marital success? It's not a subjective feeling of love and affection. There are going to be times you not really feel pretty good about your spouse. The key to it is commitment, the being committed to the institution of marriage, that you feel like it brings value to life and to society and to the community, but more importantly, commitment to your particular marriage. There are many people who are committed to the concept of marriage. They think it's a great idea, just not with the person I'm with. So they're thinking, if I can get rid of this spouse, I'll find somebody else, I'm going to be happier. But the data kind of belies that, because we know that there's a slightly higher divorce rate failure rate among second marriages and third marriages compared to first marriages. So often, you know, I think a person who's struggling with unhappiness and they happen to be married will often look at exiting that marriage as a kind of a panacea for all of their problems in life. And often the problems are not about the marriage. It's about other issues, you know, midlife issues in terms of what am I going to do for the rest of my life, my career, existential questions. And so there are a lot of things that people may be frustrated about that they have little control or ability to change, but they can sure control and change whether they're married or not. And so that's often some action a person will take in response to frustrations in other areas of life. But the marriage tends to be the hot spot where it plays itself out.
I feel like you've laid out a very clear and systematic and well-articulated evidence-based perspective on, you know, someone who's seriously contemplating divorce. But I wonder if you've ever gotten any pushback on that of someone saying like, oh, you know, since you're advocating for giving the marriage more time, that that might reflect an imposition of values.
Well, I think to a degree, and if and to that extent, I would say if we look at the data, and again, statistics only apply to aggregates, not individuals. So you can't extrapolate group data and apply it to a specific marriage or a specific couple. We do know that people who are married tend to score higher in general life satisfaction. They tend to score higher in terms of life expectancy, in terms of general health. So we know that as groups that being married is better than not being married. But absolutely, you can't then extrapolate from that and say, therefore, every couple should remain married. Not at all with that. And I think there are clearly times when ending a marriage is in the best interest of one or both partners. I just try to encourage individuals and couples who are struggling in an unhappy marriage not to move reactively to end the marriage, but to be more cautious and deliberate, give it some time with that. But I'm also very respectful that the most common couple that I see is where one person will come in, spouse, and say, I'm committed to this marriage. I want to keep it together. I want to fix it. We got problems. The other person says, yeah, we got problems and I'm ambivalent. Part of me wants to leave this, cut my losses. Part of me wants to stay because I took the vows or we've got children together, whatever it may be. So that committed spouse and that ambivalent spouse, I respect that ambivalence. I'll try to do one of the solution-focused scaling questions. If you had to put a percentage on it, you know, or 1 to 10, where would you put yourself in terms of your level of commitment? As long as there's any expressed level of commitment, true ambivalence, then I encourage them to put some energy and time into exploring that. The third kind of couple that I run into is where both are ambivalent, a little tougher to work with. And the fourth kind, which is really difficult, is the hidden agenda spouse. And that's where they come in and they'll present as either a committed ambivalent couple or mutually ambivalent couple. But the hidden agenda spouse is where one person has made an absolute decision to end the marriage and they're just trying to find a graceful way to do it. They're trying to bide their time or perturb the system to such a degree that their spouse pulls the trigger. And so when I suspect there's a hidden agenda, I'll often see each of them individually. You know, I always see couples together for the initial session, but I may see them one-on-one and check it out and to say, what do you want to see happen here? Now, a lot of times this will kind of emerge after a number of therapy sessions when you find that the couple or one person is not being compliant with maybe a homework assignment or they're not following through or they're yes-butting or that sort of thing. So I take what my clients tell me at face value until I'm confronted with information of the contrary. So when I see somebody who is not doing the kinds of things that could improve the marriage, it suggests to me that perhaps they don't want to improve the marriage, that they've made the decision to leave. And I respect that. What I then talk with them about is let's talk about a strategy of how you can move that forward. Because if this is what you want to do, it's your life and it's your choice. And I'd like to be able to help you and help your spouse move through that transition. So again, I'm not here to try to talk you out of your decision. I'm here to be of support or to help you move in a direction that you feel is going to be best for you. And again, that is based on a respect for my client that they are in charge of their lives and they're the ones who have to make the decisions that are going to impact their lives from, you know, this point forward.
Well, the way you describe it, it sounds like, you know, I guess we would say clinically that's a form of confrontation, right? But it's not done in a combative way. It's almost like a curious way as, you know, part of that continuing intake process of just gathering more accurate information. Do you ever have, you know, a deep suspicion that, you know, one person has a hidden agenda and yet they don't really cop to it?
I do, but I've gotten out of the habit a long time ago of trying to be a lie detector and second guess my clients, because even though I'm pretty good at reading things and reading situations, there's always the false positive that comes in with that. So what I do functionally as a therapist is I take what my client tells me at face value until I'm confronted with evidence to the contrary. And then I will point out that contradiction. You know, you're telling me that you would like for this marriage to stabilize and improve, but yet when we talk about things that you might be able to do to move in that direction, you're either unwilling or unable to do that. And I'm a little confused by that. You know, we had a homework assignment that I asked the two of you to have a date night and to enjoy each other's company, but not talk about any problems. But yet date night never materialized. And I'm just kind of curious about that. You know, you're putting too much energy, too much time and money into coming to work with me so that I can be helpful and then not following up. And it's not that I'm admonishing you for not doing it, because I think all behavior provides information, but I'm curious, you know, what about that? And so often when I find that clients, they used to use the term resistance, which I don't use, it's an old psychoanalytic term. But when you encounter that kind of what looks like to some people as resistance, it's actually communication. It's actually conveying that, you know, perhaps I'm not on board with the stated goal of staying in this marriage and improving. So I think to try to check it out, one of the things that I try to do and falls back into my training is to take covert issues that clients have and make them overt, bring them to the surface and talk about it. And so I can't guarantee that. And by taking what a client tells me at face value, I run the risk of being duped, but you know, so be it. I mean, you know, I'm compensated for my time, and I can't put a price on my effort and my desire to be helpful. All I can do is put a price on my time. And I say to clients often, I have no desire to waste my time and waste your time and money. So I'm here to help. If you would, you know, like for me to be helpful in this process on a temporary basis, I'm certainly available. But if this is not something you're desiring, I'm perfectly fine, you know, not being part of that. So what I have found is that clients often appreciate that candor and honesty. You know, I try to be very genuine and very transparent about my role and what I'm trying to do.
You mentioned solution-focused earlier, and one of the solution-focused approaches that I use that very much mirrors your philosophy and your perspective is to say to the clients, you know, like, you've made a lot of moving parts have to fit in place just to get here today. And, you know, you've taken the time to drive here. And of course, this is incredibly expensive because couples counseling is not covered by insurance. You know, what would we have to talk about, or what would you want to work on today so that when y'all are driving home and you're looking back on this time that you feel like, wow, that was actually worthwhile. Everything that it took to get here or whatever it cost, that was worth my time. And I'm very much of the same mindset, you know, and I love the way you said this, that you are is, you know, I'm going to take everything they say at face value, that I'm not going to be suspicious or too in my head or like, you know, condemning or judgmental of what's being said until the evidence is to the contrary. And I've really found for myself as someone who's only, you know, done counseling for about 6 years, that allows me just to be so present. And then it's that genuineness and that very much being in the moment and non-judgmental that over time allows for that honesty and that transparency on both ends to kind of come to the fore.
It does. And I, you know, I guess part of it is just the probably worked with more, tried to calculate that some time back, but probably more than 2,500 couples in my career, not sessions, but couples with that. And I find that if you look at what's emerged in terms of common factors theory about counseling, it's about the relationship. And I find that while I do have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge that can be useful to my clients, it's the genuineness of one human being truly wanting to help another human being or another couple with that. And if I can convey that, if I can come across that way, I think that not only do clients respect that, but it also lays the groundwork for me to be a useful resource for them with that. So I put a premium on that and, you know, just try to put it out there and let them know that the choices are theirs, the responsibilities theirs, and I'm here to help.
Well, as you acknowledge, you strive in a very focused, concerted way to be a resource to your clients, especially to couples and families. But you also said earlier that another way that you strive to be a resource is through consultation. And I currently teach a consultation and collaboration course right now. And it's one of those things that I never had a course on that. I almost kind of learned really the formal methods through teaching this course. What do you think that counselors should know about the value and benefit of offering consultation services and being resources to, you know, various agencies or schools or individuals?
That's a great question. You know, I think a lot of times we put labels on the activities that we engage in, and it's perceived in a different way. A good example is life coaching. Well, life coaching's counseling. Life coaching's therapy. You're just calling it something different, and people perceive it in a particular way. I think consultation is when we have information that a group of people may benefit from, or a group of people are struggling with the collective issue, and we may have expertise, we may have experience that we can share with that. And so I think for our field of counseling and our specialization of family counseling, that certainly being able to share that with groups and, you know, talking to churches, to synagogues, talking to school districts, talking to array of religious community organizations is important, because I think part of our professional responsibility is to make our services available to the public. And it's somewhat paradoxical, because we shouldn't solicit for clients. We don't go out on the street corner and, you know, have a sandwich board and say, you know, come see me. But conversely, we have a responsibility to make the community aware of our existence and what we have to offer. And so it's kind of a fine line there. But I think that this is something that we shouldn't just wait for the clients to come knock on our counseling office door to receive help, but to maybe be out there in the community offering information, providing seminars, providing things at the library for free that would be useful to the community. And for some, it would be a stepping stone or even a catalyst to going into individual couples or family counseling. But for some people, the information's enough. It's just, oh, that's something I can take home, and my spouse and I can use that, or my, you know, I can use this in my parenting with my children. So I'm a keen believer that consultation is an important and necessary part of what we do in the counseling profession. And it's also an area where we have, I think, tremendous potential for growth. Now, some of that consultation is not going to be compensated. It's going to be a community service sort of thing. At other times, it would be. Other times, you may be brought in to provide that information, compensated for your time. So you kind of have to, each person's circumstances are different. You have to kind of balance out how that might work in terms of the being able to provide for yourself, but also at the same time being able to provide services to the larger community.
Well, say we have a listener out there who has been formally contracted to enter into a paid relationship with an agency or a school or a church community. Could you speak to some of the kind of dispositional qualities that might be more innate within counselors than in other professions, or skills that we've been trained in that you see as very transferable that put us in a unique position to have a lot to offer when we seek out or receive those paid positions?
Right. I think there's the potential that counselors can do something unique and different vis-a-vis other professions, but by no means is it there. By no means is it universal. You know, one of the things that we continue to grapple with in our profession is our identity, our scope of practice. And while we would like to be able to say in a perfect world that the mental health professions of psychology, social work, marriage and family therapy, counseling, all have separate and distinct training, identity, and functions, they don't. There's tremendous, tremendous overlap. So you'll find a lot of psychologists who are very empathic and very health-focused and non-pathological in their view. And then you'll have counselors who want to be junior psychiatrists and basically look at things from a pathological medical model viewpoint. What I've aspired to and what I would love to see our profession move toward is to say we tend to view the human condition whenever possible in non-pathological terms, that we tend to aspire to healthier living, to aspire to building healthier relationships, rather than putting the lens on the eradication of pathology. And, you know, we understand the history of that because the original mental health profession was psychiatry, which was a specialization of medicine. And so everything was looked at through that medical model lens. But we're still suffering from the hangover that psychoanalysis and psychiatry has given us. And it's not that that hasn't been effective for many people, but I think we have something different to offer. When I was in California, and this was during my stint as president of the American Counseling Association, I testified in Sacramento a number of times about the pending licensure for counselors, California, the last state to get licensure. And those were questions I was asked, is how's counseling different? Why should we license counselors in California? We already have marriage and family therapists. We have social workers. We have psychologists. What do you guys bring to the table that we don't have by supporting and expanding these existing positions? And so it caused me to kind of give some thought to that. And of course, one of the things that we can do as counselors is provide very effective services at a cost-effective level. And the fact that there's just not enough qualified providers to go around to meet the needs of society. 40 years ago, the main impediment to people receiving counseling services, therapy services, was stigma. You only go to see these people if you're crazy. Now that's no longer the case. Now the number one impediment is access to affordable services. But when I consult in other countries, the primary impediment is still stigma. You know, whether you're talking about Saudi Arabia, you're talking about Turkey or Malaysia, that many people are reluctant to seek out a counselor because they see this as kind of a red flag. And so at least in our culture, at least in the U.S., we've moved away from less stigmatization to asking for help and receiving help. And there's the old saying, you probably heard it, a stitch in time saves nine. So if we can help people earlier, we can intervene earlier, I believe we prevent a wide range of problems that otherwise are going to blossom and come to fruition down the road. So I'm real glad to see this change in my career, that people are more savvy and willing to seek out professional help earlier rather than later.
That makes me also think, too, of the necessity and importance of us as clinicians taking care of ourselves.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things that you do to help take care of yourself, or resources that you seek out to make sure that you're providing effective services and that you're striking that appropriate work-life balance?
I haven't always done a good job with that. And one of the things that I really try to emphasize with my students is that all of your education, all of your training, all of your clinical experience, all of your work in helping others in no way inoculates you to problems of the human condition. In no way. You're going to have relationship problems. You're going to have marital problems, likely. You may even end up facing a divorce or two or even three. You're going to have problems with children. You're going to have problems with finances. You're going to have problems with in-laws. You're going to feel anxious. You may become depressed. And when we as counseling professionals start to think that somehow we're more highly evolved or we're at some place where we're immune to the human condition, we're setting ourselves up for a lot of grief. So I encourage my colleagues and I encourage my students to practice what you preach. Most problems in life can be effectively addressed through one's own efforts. But when a problem persists, or when a problem emerges that is of a magnitude that you find overwhelming, that's when professional help can be useful. So I encourage people to turn to a counselor, turn to a marriage counselor, turn to, and it doesn't have to be a counselor. It could be any mental health professional that you have confidence in with that. So I think we need to practice a lot of self-care with that, because I've seen time and time again, say in my particular area of marriage counseling and couples therapy, if I'm struggling with marital issues or I'm on the verge of facing a divorce, it makes it real difficult to compartmentalize that and work effectively with couples. So the self-care is not just for my own benefit. It's so that I can maintain my effectiveness with my clients. But I think the first step in that is acknowledging that we're not immune to problems of the human condition because of our education, because of our training and what we do. And I've seen anecdotally, if anything, that people in the counseling profession and related professions actually probably have a higher level of distress in some areas because they have higher expectations. They're working with people who are improving their marriage, but yet they go home and they're struggling maybe with relationship issues that aren't improving in their own lives. And so I think that there can be a toxic effect of dealing with problem issues day in and day out, there can be a higher level of expectations that we impose upon ourselves and our partners that can come back to bite us. So my advice very clearly is monitor yourself closely, do all the things we tell our clients to do in terms of healthy living, lifestyle, sleeping, avoiding alcohol and substance abuse, issues with that. And then when you encounter issues, seek out professional help. Don't be a hypocrite.
Could you also speak to the role of peer consultation in addressing some of those issues?
I can. There are some colleagues who will actually have small groups of people who will get together periodically, maybe once a month for lunch or just to have coffee, who kind of share issues with that. But it's exactly what you're saying. It's kind of a peer consultation. It's not really a therapeutic intervention. I'm real keen about that. In fact, one of the things that I feel very blessed is to have a group of colleagues that I could pick up the phone with, that I reconnect with at professional conferences, which is probably the primary motivation for me to come to a conference, is to reconnect with my colleagues and to help my students kind of meet people in the field. But I think those types of social relationships, those types of support connections are critically important, particularly counselors who are in full-time private practice. That can be very, very isolating. And unless you intentionally structure your professional life in a way that you have those support systems, you can't really turn to your spouse or your family or your children or your relatives and confide in them maybe about professional issues because of confidentiality concerns with that. So I think having a professional network, a small, close group of trusted colleagues is something that is very, very useful.
You referenced earlier your extensive international travel. Could you share a bit about the Oxford and Scotland Institutes that IMFC has developed over time?
I would love to. This kind of grew out of some earlier career work where I did study abroad programs for a number of universities. But this year, we are offering in the month of July the Oxford Family Counseling Institute. And this is the 18th year that we've offered this institute under the aegis of IMFC. And we originally started this out in various locations for a number of years. We did it at the University of Northampton, but this will be the fourth year that we've offered it at St. Hilda's College, which is one of the colleges at Oxford University. And we love the venue. We have a great working relationship. By design, we keep the institute small. We cap it at 60 participants, and about half of those participants are from the United States and divided into three different groups: graduate students, practicing counselors, and counselor educators. Those are kind of the three American groups of that. But about half the group are from international. So we have counselor educators, practicing counselors from a wide range of countries. And in the past, this has included colleagues from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, China, Taiwan, Nigeria, Germany, Ireland, the UK, various places with that. As director of the institute, I have by design kind of imposed that we keep it to 60 people, because I think if you get to a conference where you have 200, 300, 400 attendees, that's a great experience, but you're not going to have the intimate interaction that not only do we have the formal scientific and scholarly programs where people share research and clinical techniques, but we have the cultural immersion aspect where we take day trips to various points in the UK. So not only are you learning about culture in the UK, which is a very multicultural nation, but you're also looking at the intercultural connections within our group, within the United States, between countries, and I find it an incredibly enriching and fulfilling experience. In fact, if you look at the data, we have a lot of participants who come for multiple years. They'll go 1 year and say, I had such a great time, I'm going next year. So we have this year already have a number of people registered, and many of them have been for the past 2 or 3 years. We try to keep it as affordable as possible so that graduate students are able to attend. And so what we basically do is we price it out to cover our expenses with that, add 5-10% in case of currency fluctuation, because we have to pay in UK pounds. But it's a delightful program, and I hope to be involved with it to a long extent. About 4 years ago, two of my colleagues, Dr. John Beckenbach and Dr. Sean Patrick, who've assisted me with the Oxford program in Northampton earlier, came up with the idea that we offer a sister program in Scotland. And so 3 years ago, we instituted the Scotland Summer Counseling Institute. somewhat different in that it takes a broader sense, often looks at social justice issues and a broader sense, whereas Oxford is focused more on couples and family issues with that. But we find it's a good sister program that the dates are immediately after the Oxford program. So we have people who will go to both Oxford, then go to Edinburgh, or we'll have people who will go to either program independently. And while they're separate programs, we coordinated in such a way so that, you know, one of the big cost factors is airfare. So if you're going to bite the bullet on buying airfare to the UK, it's not a whole lot more to simply tack on another week. The Oxford Institute and the Scotland Institute are about week long each. I think this year it's 7 nights in Oxford and 6 nights in Edinburgh. And for some folks, it's tough to take off 2 weeks. For others, ideal because of their summer schedule. So anybody who may be interested in either the Oxford Family Counseling Institute or the Scotland Summer Counseling Institute could contact me, at my university, bcanfield@fau.edu. You could go to the IMFC website, imfconline.org, and would be glad to send you a complete program packet, and we would welcome your participation.
I hear from time to time from individuals or students who are interested in moving abroad in counseling full-time, say in the UK, but are kind of at a loss for finding resources or a pathway for doing that. Based on your experience, how viable an option is that for an American clinician?
Well, it's viable in some ways and it's unrealistic in others. One thing you've got with the UK, you've got Brexit coming about. So, getting a job in the EU, unless you're a citizen of an EU country, is formidable. But actually, a quick path is to get involved with the U.S. Department of Defense. Because with American bases throughout Europe, they have a need for counselors of all types, therapists of all types. And so you can often go to the DOD website and find some really good jobs. I was doing a workshop at the European branch of the American Counseling Association some years back, and we were at a luncheon. And I was sitting next to a guy who was a school counselor. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm a school counselor in Germany at an American school." And I said, "How'd you get into the gig?" And he said, I was looking for a job after my master's degree, applied online, didn't hear anything. Then they said, "When can you come?" And he said, "I got a job there," and said, "Thought it'd be good to spend a year or so, in Germany, being able to see your, how long have you been doing that?" He said, "Oh, I'm in my 17th year now." So there are a lot of careers that you can find through the DOD. And interesting, when you have a DOD career, as long as you're licensed for independent practice in one state in the U.S., you don't have to worry about any other licensure. Whereas it's easier to practice for a DOD facility in Europe than it is to move from one state to the other because we don't have the automatic reciprocity of licensure with that. So that's one path. Now, the idea of a person going over and independently setting up shop is going to be more formidable. But surprisingly, many countries and many nations don't have regulation. And so it's kind of a person can go out, offer services, and as long as they're not encroaching upon an established profession like psychology or social work in some countries, you call yourself a counselor, you could pretty much set up shop. Now, that was how it was in the U.S. 30 years ago when we only had about 5 or 6 states with licensure, is that you could certainly go into practice, but it's not regulated by the government. It's kind of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. So you have to demonstrate through your education, through your experience, through your professional association credentials, what qualifies you to provide the work. You also run into local issues in terms of what are the legalities in terms of malpractice and those kinds of things. So I would say anybody who's serious about living abroad or working abroad, either consider a DOD position, an employee of an American company in terms of an EAP, Employee Assistance Program type of thing, or connect with a colleague in that country and try to partner with them. And do it that way. So yeah, it can be done, but it's not an easy thing that you just pick up and move and do it. It's going to take a lot of research and a lot of groundwork depending upon the country and the location.
Well, you've acknowledged previously that you were president of ACA and that you have, an extensive history of witnessing the evolution and growth of the counseling profession, but also being instrumental in that. So with that wealth of experience, where do you see the counseling profession headed, or what's your hope for the future of our profession?
Yeah, we've struggled from time to time. And right now, there's a little bit of a dip in membership in the American Counseling Association, as there are in most professional associations with that. we've seen a proliferation of organizations that compete for membership dues, that compete for conference attendance with that. But if you go back to the history of, and using ACA as an example, ACA was founded in the mid-50s by four organizations that had kind of a similarity with counseling, and they united together to provide a common voice on those issues that they shared rather than their differences. And that those four original organizations have changed over time, and they've morphed, and we now have, I believe, 20 divisions within the American Counseling Association. Some of those divisions are identity-focused, like school or clinical mental health or marriage and family therapy. Others are interest-focused, working with social justice issues, working with religious issues, working with military concerns and things like that. But I think it's important to recognize that counseling has never been, and I don't believe it ever will be, a monolithic, unified profession. And so we need to acknowledge that, that if we're trying to create ourselves into some image of a singular profession, it's not our history. It certainly doesn't reflect the diversity of our membership with that. So my encouragement and what my hope is that we can tend to look at things in terms of a common philosophy that unites us as a profession and to accept the differences without acrimony.
So for those listeners out there who might be interested in getting involved with IMFC, what might be some great initial areas to look into?
I belabor this with my graduate students all the time. The first thing I would say is that you have an obligation to be involved in your profession. And you're involved in your profession by membership in your association or associations. Because it's through the association that we have the ability to obtain recognition from the larger society. Professional associations support legislation that create licensure, that create scope of practice, that define who we are and who we can help, what we can do. So as members of the profession, we have, an obligation, a moral and professional obligation to be involved. So you do that at a couple of levels. One is you join. And there are all kinds of organizations out there who will take your dues money. So you know, if you don't have deep pockets, you have to be selective. So I would say at a bare minimum, you want to join the American Counseling Association or a national division that reflects your area of specialization. That may be school counseling, it may be clinical mental health, it may be marriage and family therapy at the national level. And then you also want to look at your state branch of ACA. You know, so for example, in Louisiana, that would be the Louisiana Counseling Association. There are also state branch divisions that you can join. There are, you know, once calculated that there are probably over 260 counseling organizations in the country that one could join if you had the inclination and the money to pay the dues every year to do that. So I'd say professionally, we need to be members of maybe two or three, but pick one to kind of focus your interest in. So dues allows you to be a member and support the efforts of the organization. The second thing is go to the professional conference. That's where you meet people. That's where you network. That's where you reaffirm the connections in the profession. It's a small profession. You've heard the parlor trick of 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon, where you know people are, well, in the counseling profession, it's maybe 2 degrees. If you don't know somebody directly, you know somebody who does, and it's a small group. And so if you have any aspirations for career moves, getting hired as a assistant professor, first get-go out of graduate school, getting a clinical job, moving with that, it's your connections in professional associations that's going to open those doors. You don't want to be one of 50 CVs that are sent in for a job because somebody says, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. I had coffee with him at the conference, or we went and had a beer, you know, after the plenary session. If they make that connection with you, it's going to help you advance your career. These are also people who will support you, and we talked about some of the other things in terms of being in connection with that. The third phase after paying the dues and being a member, attending the conferences, is to put yourself out there and get involved. Serve on committees. Let the president, let the board, somebody on the board of directors know of your interests. And you start out serving on committees. You start out doing things in terms of coordinating podcasts, helping things. I mean, it's wonderful things that you can do that may parallel your interests with that. And then from there, you're going to be recognized and tapped for leadership roles. You're going to be invited for maybe serve as board member at large. You may be invited to serve as secretary or treasurer. Then that's going, for some people, it's going to go to higher leadership positions as president and that sort of thing. ACA basically draws its leadership from the governing council, which are represented by the 20 national divisions. And those representatives typically have served leadership roles in the division or the region and then moved into national leadership roles with that. So I would say that would be kind of the way to look at it is gauge your circumstances. For some people, they don't have the time or energy or their life isn't structured to do more than simply be a member, get the newsletter, stay in touch, occasionally attend a conference. But then I would say if you really want to get involved, put yourself out there on committee work, assist officers, assist people who are coordinating conferences, and then from there move into leadership roles. That would be kind of the step ladder to getting involved.
And you outlined, you know, many great opportunities to get involved, but that may seem like a daunting task for someone out there who hasn't taken that first step. Would you be open to offering a word of encouragement for someone out there who's considering getting involved, but maybe is on the fence?
Sure. We are always, I use IMSC as an example, we're always looking for people who want to be involved. And so don't wait for somebody to tap you on the shoulder and say, we'd like for you to get involved. Seek them out. When you meet them at a conference, say, you know, I'd really like to serve on a committee. I had a gentleman who was in Oxford last year and who, you know, we were sitting around, I think having a pint after one of the sessions, he said, you know, I'd really like to get more involved. Is there anything I could do? And I said, absolutely. I said, would you like to serve on the international committee? And so we got him plugged in and he's been a great contributor, has some wonderful ideas. So don't wait for the organization to seek you out. Let somebody that you know who's in a leadership position, and it's perfectly fine to say, I'm here, I'm willing, I'm available, I'd like to get more involved. And it may start out something fairly modest, serving on a conference planning committee or a subcommittee or doing something like that. But the organization is keenly interested in getting an infusion of fresh blood, new ideas and energy with that. And one of the reasons I really encourage my graduate students to attend conferences is for that reason. I want them to meet people. I want them to get plugged in. And it may not be an immediate payoff for them professionally or personally, but it does lay the groundwork for that to happen in the future.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. And as I wrap up, I'd love to ask you a question that I close every episode with. I would just ask that you think about a time maybe where you had a perspective or, you know, a thought or a feeling about something that wasn't beneficial or it was kind of an impediment to what you were hoping to accomplish. And you were just able to reframe that perspective and it made all the difference.
I think part of it was my frustration when I served as ACA president. I had really hoped that we could find some way to unify ACA membership with the division membership, with the state branch membership, to have kind of a structured, comprehensive dues that would allow people to be members of ACA, their state branch, and one division with that. And it got shot down. And it got shot down because nobody saw it in their best interest, because these entities, even though they on the surface say we collaborate with each other and we support each other, they compete with each other. You know, a good example is the Texas Counseling Association. Wonderful organization. They put on a bang-up state conference that, you know, in size rivals ACA if it doesn't exceed ACA. And so it would be great to have all TCA members, members of ACA, and all ACA members within Texas, members of TCA. But it just didn't materialize. So we made a wonderful presentation to the ACA Governing Council. It was deliberated. It didn't pass with that. And so what I took away from that was kind of an acceptance that things sometimes evolve in an organic way. If there is resistance to this idea of kind of uniformity in due structure and membership, there's a reason for it. And that even when you're in a high leadership position within an organization, you kind of have to recognize the group is more powerful than an individual, that certainly the group is more powerful than any leader within the organization. And so you kind of have to go with the flow. So part of what I've encouraged, and some of my colleagues who subsequently served in the role of ACA president, is to say, you're going to serve for a year. You're not in a position to really bring about any miraculous change, but you can kind of maybe redirect things two or three points. It's kind of like steering a super tanker. You're not going to turn it on a dime, but you can maybe turn it in a little different direction. And over time, if you get like-minded people kind of moving in that direction, you can change the course of the organization. So again, that all comes back to being involved. It all comes back to serving in a volunteering to serve in a leadership role and recognizing that professional change is only going to occur if we take responsibility for it. There's not someone else out there to do it. And if we abdicate that responsibility, we really don't have much to complain about. We pretty much accept what's given to us.
The Reframe is a production of the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join me next month on The Reframe.